Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Tracy Ullman is the first British woman to be offered her own television sketch shows in both the United Kingdom and the U.S. Over the course of her 30-plus year career, her sketch comedy has earned her a reputation as an unparalleled impressionist. In her latest series, Tracy Ullman's Show, which aired in the United States last Friday on HBO, she tackles current events and British icons, but also manages to spoof American culture along the way. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Tracy Ullman back to our show.
Hello, Leonard. It's lovely to be back.
And this was done for the BBC originally?
Yes. I found myself being asked to go to the BBC to do a show for the first time in 30 years. The two women were running the department that commissioned the show, Charlotte Moore, who's now head of all programming, and my family Moore was head of comedy. And I think, you know, I thought, wow, 30 years ago, it was run by five guys in bow ties who, like the goons, had fallen in the war. What? More National Service jokes, hey? Ha, ha, ha. Really was. Wow.
But it's very much more high culture.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a man called Clive lurking around in suede shoes at the end of any BBC corridor, somebody doing Wimbledon. So there's vestiges of it left, the BBC. But I was thrilled to be asked, and so
And
here
how
I
many
am.
Shows in the series?
I did six, which are being shown now on HBO, and I've just done another seven, which I hope will also be shown on HBO. But it's my take on the world of, I think every 10 years or so, Leonard, I seem to look at my surroundings and try and be everybody in society and update, you know, how I'm feeling about life and the world and everything.
Don't you hold both British and US citizenship?
I do, yeah.
I've so where lived do you live most 30 of the years. Time?
I try and live in both places. I think I've lived in the USA more, actually, in the last 30 years, but I'm spending a lot of time in London at the moment. My daughter lives and works there. It's like a global hub. You know, you've lived and worked in London. You were telling me a long time ago at the Royal Court and places, and you went to school there.
All I did was move sets until I complained that it was too heavy, it was too hard to do, and then they had me pulling flies.
Oh, you're bitching about stuff. You were doing the American stuff. My back, I get an injury at work.
Exactly.
You got in there like, oh,
and
shut up,
I was working
up,
illegally,
silly boy.
Too.
Were you?
Because I was on a student visa.
I see. But London changed so much, you know. We were like,
first of all, it's a lot more expensive than it was when I was a student.
It's this buzzing global hub, multi-ethnic melting pot, and it was like suddenly, you know, it seemed like New York, it seemed like Singapore, it seemed like all these, you know. And I was very excited by what happened within Europe, so I did a show about it, and then we voted for Brexit this year, so I'm sort of strange.
I assume that you've been following the election here, and the role that sketch comedy has played in relieving some of the tension. Mm. Have you wanted to jump in and do your own impressions of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
I think Kate McKinnon and Alec Baldwin are doing an amazing job.
But you bear a certain physical resemblance to Hillary.
Well, you know me.
You
it takes
bear
me a
physical
while to
resemblance
get it
to everybody.
I look good in wigs because I've got a big head, evidently. I think they're doing a great job. I mean, I love, thank God for Saturday Night Live every 4 years. I mean, Tina Fey doing Sarah Palin just made things bearable for me a few years ago. But maybe I'll do it next year on my show when one of them gets elected and I'll have them having a little trip to London.
Well, you've said that after tensions die down, you'd like to try doing Melania.
Yeah, she's interesting to me. It's where she comes from. But as people, a lot of people speak like this in London, and I don't know quite where they're from. So you go in a coffee shop in London, you go, they have a very strange accent. You don't know where they're from now. And you go, where are you from? You have to guess one of the Stan countries or somewhere. It's this extraordinary mixture of accents in there. I think I'll I'll do that later on. Let things simmer down. Heaven forbid I get anybody's ire at this point with a week to go.
Some must be easier to do than others, and I would assume that Melania might be easier than...
It'd be jolly hard to look like her, that sort of young and glamorous. They're harder to look like. It's like some people just come more naturally to me, and I can hear where the voice is inside their head. And one of my more successful ones at the moment is Judi Dench.
Yes, the show opened with you made up to look like Judi Dench, and she's shoplifting. What made you think of her as a serial shoplifter, a petty criminal with a real
mean streak? But if she gets caught, she says, "Oh no, I couldn't possibly have done that. I'm a national treasure." And so then people go, "Oh no, yeah, that's right. Of course you didn't." You know, those two wonderful writers, Andy Reilly and Kevin Cecil, had that conceit for her that she could do anything. You know, and scratch cars in plain sight and get away with it.
Steal booze. Jeremy Irons once described Dame Judi to me as a giggler. Do you know if she's found this funny?
She's been terrific about it. She actually did respond. She, after the show went out, she accepted an award and got up and said, "Hello, I'm Tracy Ullman." And she had a meeting or something that day at somewhere and pretended to steal something as she left. And then my daughter sent me a tweet yesterday from Judy's daughter, Finty. And Finty said that Judi was watching me being her. And she said, "I don't remember filming that."
That's the ultimate compliment, isn't it, Tracy?
The makeup's astounding. Floris Schuller, a Dutch guy, is a sculptor. He's a real great artist, and he does these makeups for me. It's really particularly good.
It took me a little while to realize. I thought, well, she got Judi Dench to do her show. I thought,
did you?
How impressive.
I fooled Leonard Lopate. Hey. And you're a smart guy. So we think you are.
Well, I'd like to believe I am, but I know. Well, your impression of Angela Merkel is hilarious. Have you been doing her for a while?
I just decided to put her within this mix for this series. I admire her and have found her very interesting. I just like when she speaks to the public in England and she tries to be that, you know, hello. And I remember years ago, do you remember when George W. Bush went up behind her and hugged her? Mm-hmm. And her whole body went, you know, it was like she didn't want to be hugged. It's like, it was, anyone hugs the Queen, it makes me die laughing. The Queen came to DC a few years ago and a big African-American lady got a hold of her. She went, "I'm just so happy to see you." And the Queen literally went, "Wah!" You know, and her handbag dropped. I love seeing people having to be. I imagine Angela Merkel is the only girl in the room and imagines that everybody fancies her. Everybody thinks I'm sex bomb and is after me. But, and I've put her with her and another astonishing makeup that Floris did. I really enjoy being Angela Merkel and physically moving like her and being
well in one
singing.
Scene.
She sings a lot. If you watch the show, I do a lot of singing as Merkel.
Yeah, and you've started singing. You actually made a record because of something that happened at a hairdresser's.
I like to try everything in my career. This is years ago, Leonard. I had a top 10 hit here in 84 with a song called They Don't Know. I worked at MTV as a VJ for a few weeks because of that. I was terrible. But, so I like to sing. I can carry a tune and I like to have the characters sing. And I like to tap dance too. I tap dance in the photo.
You do it all.
Anything. I try anything.
In one scene, Angela Merkel is angry that, given her importance, she would be forced to go to Cardiff, Wales. This is, at least in part, a play on the rivalries between the UK and Germany. Do you think the jokes, those kinds of jokes, play well with American audiences? Do you think we would understand?
It's funny. I write that character with a lady called Georgia Pritchard, who's written for Veep for a few years. Mm. So, funny, on the writers on the show, they all write. They write for Veep and for me, and so they have this sort of, they've done a lot of political stuff, and it just seemed funny because there is the G, but Obama's always going to Cardiff for those G8s, and it just, you know, it's a bit of a dig at Cardiff, but I love Cardiff, actually. You always have to say that. Oh, Cardiff, it's a really great place. Boyo.
There's another joke that there's nothing to do in Scotland except to have referendums.
That's right. There's nothing to do in Scotland except have referendums. Yeah, that's political satire for you. Actually, this year's show, I do Nicola Sturgeon. Do you know who she is? The SNP, the one that, you know, that talks about the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got done her this year. Her and Angela are kind of rivals.
How did that happen for you? Did you realize at a very young age that you had the ability to do that kind of thing, to do impressions better than most other people? I know sometimes there are certain people I do well. Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger.
Okay.
Okay. He came on our show after he had an unpleasant experience the first time, so I was surprised he came back.
Oh.
He sat in the chair that you're in and he said, "I'm here because my physical therapist is your biggest fan."
And wow, you guys share a physical therapist.
No, he said that his physical therapist was a fan of mine. And so she had said to him,
you must
go on the London Low Paid Show. But anyway, but I can't do an awful lot of people.
You could hear that. I just could always do it. I mean, I have to study them. And I was just that kid that impersonated, you know, the people in my village or my teachers or my friends and did a show in my mother's bedroom. And they would find that very funny if I was somebody else. But it was always everyday people for me. There was a woman who lived opposite us who wore sort of rubber boots and a little woolen hat and had never got married because her fiancé had died in the First World War. And she was called Annie Cox. And I found her very, very poignant and empathetic. And if I impersonated her, that went down a storm in my house because it was Annie Cox. And I'd have a little sort of thing dripping off the end of my nose. She was always wiping her nose. And so it was the sadness of people that made me want to impersonate them too and be them. And so I hadn't done these famous people before, till a few years ago in one of my shows. And they're kind of Trojan horses, in a way. I'm using them to, you know, and sort of using Judy as, you know, publicity. But I like, they are such a part of society and celebrity that I felt they, you know, should be included in the shows. But I just love impersonating people. It's something I can do, and it's how I explain my world and my feelings.
Tracy Ullman starred in her own network television comedy series on Fox, Tracy Ullman Show from 1987 to 1990, later produced programs for HBO, including Tracy Takes On, that was 96 to 99, for which she won numerous awards. Her sketch comedy series, Tracy Ullman's State of the Union, ran from 2008 to 2010 on Showtime, and she now has a new show that is on the BBC and on HBO. It premiered here last Sunday night, and
Tracy Ullman's show. Yet again,
Tracy,
I put my
Ullman's
name in the
with
title.
An apostrophe. Yeah. This case, and you have some sharp comedy in there. I was worried about a spoiler, but since it's already been on the air, there's a sketch of an interview with a candidate who for a job has left just one important fact off of her resume, and when her potential employers Googled her name, they discovered that she had been convicted of crimes against humanity. But that's okay. Can I reveal why it doesn't seem to bother the potential employers?
Yeah, sure. It's been out already.
It's a bank joke.
It's a bank joke, so you can always make fun of banks. That was a wonderful sketch that it just read brilliantly from, you know, it was just a good conceit and it was funny and dramatic and weird. It was sent by a guy from Ireland that wrote a show called Father Ted, and he lives in Ireland, and he just sent this one sketch in and said, if it's anything you can use, fine, you know, if it's not, it's not. And it was just a perfect piece, and it's rather Python-esque, really. It's like something Python would have done years ago. But I found a character I wanted to do for that, you know, and my daughter's in that sketch, funnily enough. The woman that interviews me, my daughter Mabel, who never acts, doesn't want to be in show business, read that script and said, that's really sharp and weird and wonderful. Can I be in it? And we made her audition twice. So that was just a good, weird, wonderful piece. I wish I could find like 10 pieces like that for a series.
And in that case, you're not playing somebody who's well known.
No.
There's another character, Karen, in a her little bit runs through the show, and she has been reunited with her mother after 28 years. It was her boyfriend who got her into the trouble that has plagued her for 28 years. Do you was that also just a script that somebody sent in?
No, that was something I'd seen on the news about a woman being released from a Far Eastern country after 23 years and coming home. And, you know, just some people get stuck in these jails for a long, 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 long time. And it seemed to be an analogy of me coming back to the BBC, funnily enough, Leonard, as well. You know, that I go into my bedroom like, after 28 years and there was pictures of me and Adam Ant on the wall. So it was a little nod to my return, I think. But I love that piece. I like the woman plays my mother. It's just fabulous. It might have been like doing a Ken Loach film or something very naturalistic, you know, when we're sitting there and she says, how's Dad? Oh, he died. 1978, you know. Maggie died too. What, Maggie Thatcher? No, her up the road. You know, just the little conversations of how things have changed. So, but she, I would just use her for one show. She was like a little spine of a story for one show, because the conceit of the show is that it's like dawn to dusk. So you see her coming into the country in the morning and you see her going to bed at night. So she completes the show. And there was another piece I wanted to write when I was looking at news stories in England a couple of years ago, how refugees hang on under people's cars and camper vans to get into England. And they come over on the cross-channel ferries. And I saw an amazing piece of a Sudanese, young Sudanese guy dropping down from underneath somebody's RV in their driveway. And of course, people just film everything now. And this woman had got her phone out immediately. And she was going, come here, Frank, there's somebody, look at him, he's a young black fella lying in the driveway. And he's going, oh, what should we do? She went, I don't know, should we call the police? He said, no, let's make him a sandwich. And they did. And it was the kindness and the connection and how they went on. And it just that they were filming it. Do we call the police or make him a sandwich? And they made him a sandwich. And I think, you know, they helped him and they talked to him. And I loved that story. I thought that's a great story for the whole show.
Although,
a spine story.
You have to wonder whether she would have voted for or against Brexit.
I know. There you go. There's the dichotomy.
Because there's the personal level and then there's the theoretical level.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Some of the same fears that have gripped British voters, like terrorism, immigration, economic inequality and the like, have also been at work here in the United States. What role do you think that comedy plays in teasing out a more rational response to those kinds of fears?
Well, pieces like that we've just spoken about. And actually, it was tough this year. I'd written everything about Angela Merkel, and then we started filming 2 days in. The Brexit vote happened, and we had to change a lot of the scripts. And there's been a psychological shift in England since this vote. It's strange. It's uneasy, and we don't know what's coming next. And my daughter worked for an MP and was in Parliament for 5 years, and you know, she's travels the country the whole time, and I don't think it was any big surprise to her. But I have no political compass right now. It's all shifting. The political world I knew, and you have to try and understand why. And I don't think it was a completely racist vote. I mean, not everyone. Not every vote for Brexit was a racist vote, but every racist voted for Brexit. You know, it's really hard, dude. And it's an economic outcry too.
But Britain has come a long way since I was a student there. When I was looking for rooms at one point, many of the notices would say, no colored need not apply, or Europeans only.
Blacks, no Irish.
and then London became perhaps, other than Queens, New York, the most diverse place in the world.
Yeah.
And now we have Brexit. So,
well, London certainly didn't vote for it, but you have these pockets of, you know, it's just so divided up. I know, my husband's golf course up in Scotland was, no dogs or women. That's Muirfield. It's what he used to have. No dogs or women in the clubhouse.
On the other hand, England has had a couple of British women as British prime ministers, which the United States Still hasn't had a leader who's a woman as its leader. May in the future. May
I know.
Not.
I should
still
impersonate
don't know.
Her. I know. I remember Margaret Thatcher. Of course, you know, I remember I had to impersonate her a lot back in the day on Radio 4. Oh, you know, and I, you know, it was until 2 years after she got elected that I remember being a young woman then, and it hit me. I thought, oh, she's a woman. It hadn't occurred to me. So I'm very European. My whole adult life has been the European community. I remember when we went into Europe really big time and our money changed and everything and all the pensioners were saying, I don't know what a half P is. And I loved it. I mean, it's given us culture and style and food. You're all going to be laughing at
eliminated.
Us again. You're going to be laughing at us again. We're going to go back to spotted dick and steak and kidney pudding, Leonard. It made us cosmopolitan. And I love being a European. I mean it's been great for us. So I was kind of distressed by it. It's going to be terrible for us culinarily. Is that a word?
Yes, because so many French chefs came in at certain point.
They are gone now. We don't want. We don't want. You can have your pasties. You can have your body dick. Au revoir.
Now, this show has something that couldn't have occurred on the Fox show, and that is nudity. Although it's kind of fake nudity.
Yeah.
One of your characters is a newly elected MP who goes topless to work, and nudity, in fact, being bare-breasted is part of her political approach. Is that likely to actually be happening?
Yeah,
in England?
There's Danish. There is a party. There is a group of women who do protest topless, and I think run for office in, topless. So we just wanted to. I wanted to play a political character, and then we thought, how can we do a twist on it? What's happening? And then I said, well, let's have her be just a very regular lady called Sally who actually walks around with her breasts out. and so she gets elected and she has to do it. And these are my mandate, she tells people. And I didn't use my own breasts, Leonard. I did go for prosthetic breasts. That my
I
wonderful.
I can see you had a necklace in them.
You arty types. Floris Schuller, my Dutch.
Things.
Yeah, you spot those things. My Dutch makeup artist put the. They're pretty great breasts, though. And it was very hard to work with the crew that day. You know, walking around, they did look like my breasts, you know. Mm-hmm. They could either look at me above the neck, the crew, or they kept looking below the neck. It was tough for them.
You have one of the characters you do is a white male app maker who sits in a coffee shop stoking his own fears of being an endangered species. Mm. Now, that's something that we've seen a lot in this country.
Mm.
That's something that is also being talked about in England?
Yeah, yeah. And I think he's a perennial character, actually. A lot of English comedy going back for decades has been based on that kind of disgruntled guy. I don't know if you remember in the 60s, there was a actor called Tony Hancock, mm-hmm. and he played a pompous man who didn't understand why he wasn't more powerful or better, you know, making more money than he was. And I think David Brent is that character in The Office, too. Ricky Gervais is brilliant. Television show, and there is a disgruntled, disenfranchised, middle-aged white man who's working out of a Starbucks, and I think the jobs have gone now, and my daughter was working for a man with this kind of attitude. They're terrified of working for women. They just don't know how to respond and adapt, and they are. They're developing apps, and we've got this digital platform going in Finland, and, you know, I'm talking to this guy in Miami about the... It's very. I see them in the coffee shops all the time. Go around the lead. Could you go around the lead? I'm on 15%. They're always plugging in stuff. And but I, you know, he's endearing to me. He's another poignant person to me. But I think, yeah, he's very recognizable to an American audience. You see them all the time.
A listener called in to compliment you on a sketch from 20 years ago about being pulled over for a DUI. Do you remember all your old sketches?
Some of them. Yeah, that was a good one. We got to dance in that. Yeah. Joe Malone, Joe Sheck did a fabulous dance number for that. That was funny.
Do you take personal credit for the success of The Simpsons?
No. No, of course not.
But
I'm glad to be
you introduced The Simpsons to the American audience. I remember Matt Groening was on our show just after your show had ended.
Yeah.
And I asked him, what are you going to be doing now? And he said, well, you know that sketch, that little animated thing I did on the Tracy Ullman show? We're going to do it as a regular show on Fox. And I said, well, good luck with it. It's now
the
longest
genius.
Running show in the history of television.
Yes, but it did spin off from my show, and a lot of the writers from the Tracy Ullman show went on to that show. And I'm very proud to be associated with it. I just remember the first week they came to the studio and I was rehearsing all the sketches, and they said, oh, would somebody like to read the voices for this animated thing we're doing? And they said, oh, well, I said, well, I'm a bit busy because I'm... They went, okay. And Julie said, I'll do it. I don't mind. What do you want to read? What's her name, Marge? And she said, I remember that moment. And then Dan, you know, well, okay, well, I don't mind. Dan Castellaneta, the dearest, fantastic man.
You could have done all the parts.
I know. Looking at it now, Leonard. Looking at it now. And Dan was Homer, and they went off to the booth, and I remember watching them doing it. I'm thinking, I wonder if this will come to anything. Ugh, hello.
I've only seen the first of this new series. Are we going to have some recurring characters?
Yes, yes. I like Judy's back, and Maggie Smith is in lots of them. And
Maggie Smith, in this case,
Camilla
is trying out for...
I have this lovely theory, that Camilla Parker Bowles gets George the grandchildren one week, and then... you know, Kate's mum, Carol Middleton, gets them the following week, and they are totally different types of grandmothers, and I sort of do them in the show.
You do both parts?
Yes.
Is she... she used to be the most unpopular woman in the UK. Has she gotten past that?
Yeah, oh, very much so, I think. And I think she's... They're very happy, and the princes seem happy with her, and they're all... Where I used to live in London, I remember running one night. I was going running a bit late, and I remember seeing her and Charles coming out of the gate of Clarence House, and I was sort of held back by a corner, you know. I looked in the back of the car, and there they were, all glowing, and her blonde hair, and this beautiful head-made suit, and they were obviously off to some wonderful event. And I thought, look at you, you know, you did it. You got each other, and they just looked this glowing moment, and then they drove off, and I ran past.
Now, we talked about how you have found it easier to do impressions of other people than many of us. But what about accents? Have you noticed a real change? I have, where British actors now play Americans and nobody knows until they're interviewed on a show like this.
Yes, it's... I know, I thought we were just talking about
what's
Affair,
happened?
You know, that is it Ruth Wilson? And I mean, amazing. I don't know. We've gotten really good at it. And it's because of
is
YouTube
it at the Royal
and
Academy?
Being able to research better. And I think we've loosened up as actors, the Brits. No, we've gotten really good at it. And also, we now realize there's period accents. There's nothing worse than an English actor years ago. They listen to like Doity, Doit, and Doit, and they come over and they talk in this way because they watched an old movie. They think that's how they talk in New York, you know. And you say, no, that's like something you watched an old movie. You know, it's this very current accents, and London too. You've got to keep up with what the accents are in London. It's totally different now.
Well, do you think that it's, to some degree, it's because British actors have always had to do so many British accents. Their accents change in England 12 miles from the nearest town. You have a whole different accent. And actors have been very careful. They have to be, because they're going to be caught, oh, you're doing a Brighton accent when you're...
Yeah.
When you're
but
in
you've got
Leeds.
The heart and soul of the classics, though. It's still very hard for anybody to do Death of a Salesman in England. It's understanding the American psyche and sociology. You can't quite do that. So I don't want to see a production of The Front Page or Brits, quite honestly, you know.
But we're going to be...
I don't want to see Fiddler on the Roof without Jews. I mean, please.
Well, a fair number of Gentiles have played it.
I know.
Fiddler.
Remember that one production they had recently, though? It was just, no, it was all Gentiles. That's wrong.
So have you seen The Front Page, the new production?
No.
Oh. I'm going to see it. And we're going to have some of the stars on our show soon.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah. I'd love, yeah. I know we are getting good at it. Everyone's getting good at accents because of you can study them so easily. Maybe years ago, you know, if I wanted to do an accent on the Tracy Ullman show, there was no YouTube. And I used to ring people in, you know, like Brooklyn, you know, to hear their kind of voice. You know, I got to talk to my supervisor. And I would just, or ring a librarian or a car dealership or something, just so it was much harder then. But no, we are getting good at it.
Well, I look forward to seeing all the different accents in future shows. Tracy Ullman's show airs on Sunday nights at 10 o'clock here in New York on HBO. And as always, it's a great pleasure
it's
having you on our show.
It's lovely to talk to you. It's good to see you again. Thank you in your fancy, swanky new offices, studios here.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
James Rebanks has illustrated his latest book, A Shepherd's View, with color photographs that chronicle the daily life of the shepherding community of the English Lake District. The images capture the community's year-long activities, such as its competitive sheep shows, pastoral baking competitions, and the roles dogs play in keeping a flock intact. It's published by Flatiron. Shepherding is a subject Mr. Rebanks knows intimately because he runs his family-owned farm in the region. And when he's not tending to his sheep, he is busy tweeting from @Herdy Shepherd.
Herdy Shepherd 1, @Herdy Shepherd 1, yeah.
Or he serves as an expert advisor on sustainable tourism for UNESCO. His previous book, The Shepherd's Life, was a New York Times bestseller. I'm very pleased it has brought James Rebanks to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for inviting me to New York. It's an amazing place.
Ah, so this is the first time you've been here?
It's the first time I've been to America.
Wow. Well, you know, we do have sheep in America as well. But I wonder if shepherding is at all similar here. Will you be finding out?
The truth is, I need to find out. I haven't seen many sheep since I got to America. I've been in Chicago for a couple of days, and then I came to New York. But I'm guessing, because I don't know about American shepherding, but certainly our shepherding is a really, really ancient tradition. So many of the things that we still do on the farm are at least 1,000 years old. So.
And how long has your family been in the shepherding business?
My sister did our family tree to try and work that out about 5 years ago, and she got the paperwork back about 600 years, and then there is no paperwork older than that, so we assume we were there for much longer than that.
Usually with families, they go back that long. Somebody decides wants to go to law school or become a teacher.
Or leave for America, maybe.
That happened in your family?
I think there are some people with our surname in America, so maybe somebody did. But no, we have my family's story is probably the exact opposite of the story of the people that came to America. We're the people who stuck, who stayed in the place and loved the place so much and managed to hold on in that place, and we didn't leave.
Isn't the Lake District usually associated with early 19th century lake poets like William Wordsworth and Samuel Coleridge? Were the sheep always there along with the poets?
The sheep have always been there, probably for about 4,000 or 5,000 years. When I was growing up, I thought Wordsworth just wrote about daffodils and then sort of wandering lonely as a cloud. But it turns out actually Wordsworth wrote about the shepherds. He wrote these amazing poems a couple of hundred years ago about shepherds and sheep.
And although the Lake District isn't a large area, it receives 16 million tourists a year, yeah. I'm assuming mostly because they want to go to the Wordsworth house and see some of the things that those poets wrote about.
Yeah, well, actually, when those tourists are asked, when they survey them, they come because they love the landscape. So it's one of the most beautiful cultural landscapes on earth, a sort of man-made, woman-made landscape.
What's more important to the local economy, sheep or tourism?
Financially, tourism. And tourism has probably been worth more economically than sheep for a very long time. But the culture of the place, the way of life of the indigenous people, if you like, is about sheep and shepherding.
And you write that the district inspired important ideas about nature.
Yeah, the first place, the first written record of any kind of anybody talking about a national park was in the Lake District, because William Wordsworth said that it was so beautiful and so special it should belong to everybody who had an eye to see and a heart to feel, and he said it should be a kind of national park. And later the Americans actually developed national parks and have them for real before we do, but that's probably where the idea comes from.
But isn't it protected by the National Trust?
Parts of it are. So parts of it were left by writers like Beatrix Potter. She made all her money from the Peter Rabbit books, and she bought a lot of farms. I think she bought 14 farms, and she left them to the National Trust. But it isn't a state-owned landscape. A lot of it belongs to individual families, farming families.
The Lake District is the largest area of common land in Western Europe. How much common land exists in the world these days?
Less and less. So ours is a sort of rare survival of a common land. So if you can imagine this, in the valley bottoms, we have privately owned fields, but the actual mountains themselves don't belong to any of us. We have grazing rights to take a certain number of sheep to the mountain.
And you were totally spared of the Industrial Revolution?
No. In fact, the really interesting thing is the Industrial Revolution happens about 2 hours' drive down the road. So ours is the first landscape on Earth where people start to defend beautiful things and old things against the Industrial Revolution.
The photographs in your book are stunning, Did you edit them to only include fair weather shots? Although there's a lot of threatening clouds in the skies.
There are a couple of pictures in there of really lousy days. Because the truth is, if you're a shepherd, you're out all winter. You're in some of the worst weather.
Snow.
Snow and rain. And there are pictures of that in there. But it's quite difficult to take pictures of rain and snow, to be honest. But there are pictures of my father in there on a rainy day, sort of working on the land and moving sheep, and that's part of it. And in my first book, The Shepherd's Life, I wanted to write a very no-frills, unromantic account of it, so I wrote about the work and the working people.
Well, that was more of an autobiography.
It was a memoir, and I wrote somewhere in that I wanted to write the history of the nobodies, the people that nobody ever mentions, the working people that make landscapes, make cities, and that was the ethos behind writing the book. I wanted to celebrate those people.
We were just talking with Tracy Ullman about regional accents, and you write that the shepherds are descendants of the Vikings and that you switch codes between your own dialect and the Queen's English. Yeah. Can you give us an example of the shepherd's dialect?
Yeah, so we have our own way of counting. So if you count to five in our dialect, it would be Yantan, Tethra, Medra, Pip. We call it
Gael. And where would that come
from? Some of it comes from sort of Anglo-Saxon speech patterns, but a lot of our words, a lot of our dialect is almost pure Norse. So we call a gate a yat. We call the iron bar that you make a hole to put your fence post into the ground a gaeblik. We call a mole, a creature that lives under the earth that comes up, we call it a maudie warp or a maudie.
And you call a ram a tup.
We call a ram a tup. Our dialect is actually understood better in Norway than it is in London, which I think is amazing.
Doesn't talking about sheep in regular English get complicated because the same word refers to a single animal and a wide range of breeds?
Yeah, it's actually even worse than that because every time a new wave of language came into Britain, so Norman, Anglo-Saxon, Viking, every wave of invasion into England brought another word for sheep, another word for wool, another word for the meat. So that's why you have sort of mutton, lamb, etc. There's a multitude of words that come from those different linguistic traditions.
To the uninitiated, sheep are sheep, but doesn't your community keep flock books of great sheep who have lived there throughout the ages?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to write about was that I think in a modern industrial sort of farming landscape, sheep are just commodities and nobody worries too much about the individual ones. But if you look at very traditional shepherding communities like ours, the individual sheep are celebrated, the breeding of the sheep is celebrated, how they look is celebrated. So there are traditions in our landscape where we compete with the sheep, and there's very particular ideas have emerged over about 5,000 years. And I said to somebody the other day, the way we think about the sheep is another form of culture. It's like punk or Picasso. It's a real living working culture. It isn't a sort of devalued industrial food system. It has its own values and sort of ways of seeing things.
How are the flocks defined by the shepherd who breeds them or by the genetics of the sheep themselves?
The sheep look like they do because of the shepherd's work.
Because it's changed over the years. You include some old photographs here, and there's been a lot of changes in fairly recent times.
Yeah, even without doing any of the stuff that scientists can do now, even in the old days, you can change the look of an animal rapidly. So in the last 100 years, the value of wool of our sheep has crashed dramatically. So through selective breeding, basically choosing a particular kind of tup or ram, you can breed the wool off them. So they have a lot less wool than they used to have on them.
And what do you look for in a good tup? You say that they're worth half a flock.
Yeah, and that's basic maths because the male sheep can mate with up to 100, 120 females. So if you want to improve your flock, you buy these great rams that cost a lot of money. But what do we look for? Well, we look for two things, really. We look for really practical things. They've got to have really short teeth. They've got to have really tough wool to survive on a mountain.
Why short teeth?
Short teeth last longer. Trust me. If you have really short, tight-knitted teeth, you live longer on a mountain. But as well as those practical things, we're also looking, because it's happened for so long, the culture has emerged around it, we look for a certain colour of sheep, we look for a certain presence, and they become like works of art. And we look for sort of presence and character and style.
I'm speaking with James Rebanks about his latest book, The Shepherd's View, Modern Photographs from an Ancient Landscape. You mentioned that wool isn't as much of a commodity today as it was in the past, but we still have a lot of, we use wool a lot, don't we?
Yeah, but the really tragic thing is we can make plastic clothes, synthetic clothes, cheaper than we can process natural fibers like wool.
But wool is better.
Wool's amazing. When they run the science on wool, it's one of the great products in the world. So we have to rediscover wool, and we have to use it much more, and we have to add value to it, because at the moment, the fleeces of my sheep is worth less than the price of shearing them.
So when you're selling, because you write, shepherding isn't just about tending sheep, it's about breeding sheep for sale.
Yeah.
Are you breeding them for their milk, for their meat, or are you still thinking about the wool?
We're not thinking about the wool very much at all, because it's almost worthless, which is a sad statement, but true. What the mountains actually do in England is the mountains are the nursery for the whole sheep flock, for the whole country. So over the last month, the shepherds from all of the lowland areas in England travel to these sales that spring up overnight in the fields and in the towns of the north of England. And they buy the spare daughters, the ones that aren't needed to renew the flock. They buy them and they take them to lowland England, and they've done that for as long as anybody knows. They may well have done it for 2,000, 3,000 years.
You write that the keenest shepherds become artists at making their sheep beautiful. How do you make a sheep look beautiful?
Well, it isn't sort of...
don't put lipstick on.
No, not too lipstick, but to give you an example, one of the breeds that we keep is a breed called the Swaledales, which are from Yorkshire, basically. They're from the Yorkshire Dales. And they have a particular look where they have black faces with white spectacles and white noses. And you can cheat.
And they have off-color wool.
Yeah, they have a sort of peaty-colored grey wool.
Curled horns.
Yeah, and curled horns. They're amazing looking sheep. But you can cheat a little bit. To make the spectacles look cleaner, to make the nose look cleaner, you can pluck out the white hairs out of the black. It's crazy, but that's what people do in our area.
And how do they respond when you're doing this plucking?
Initially, they're probably bamboozled, but the truth is a lot of the sheep that are taken to these shows become they become prima donnas. They love the attention. They love the way that they're looked after, and they have an amazing life. They have an amazing half-wild life, and they're sort of almost worshipped by some of the shepherds, these sheep.
Have you ever judged the shepherd's meat?
Yeah, I've done quite a few. I did one about 3 weeks ago, and you can't judge in your own valley where we live. You would be asked to judge in another valley where you're not considered to be biased. But you take your life into your hands. It's like judging anything else. You're in danger of offending everybody that doesn't win.
But you're looking for the short teeth, but also legs and feet.
Yeah, there's a very particular look that each one of these historic breeds have. And each one's different. So, believe it or not, in England, there are 60, even though England's not very big, there are 60 different regional breeds, heritage breeds, and each one was selectively bred over many, many centuries to suit that particular kind of ground and that particular kind of environment. And each one has its own look. And, the shepherds of those individual breeds are all obsessive about breeding the one that looks the most perfect.
You're right that it pays to have sheep that stand out with a slightly arched Roman nose.
Yeah, I mean,
that's an aesthetic thing.
Some of the people listening, I think, were crazy. But if you're trying to breed the perfect sheep, then you want to breed these sort of very noble-looking creatures that they're very proud. And, the great ones strut around a little bit and act a little bit like a great sportsman. When you see somebody hit a home run and then stick their chest out and milk it from the crowd, that's the sort of character that we're looking for in those male sheep.
It seems that shepherding is more than just watching the sheep. You write about a baking competition?
Yeah, we at the shepherd's meet that we have in the autumn, where we all gather together in our valley, some years ago somebody decided it would be fun for the shepherds to compete to see who was the best baker, and it's become hugely competitive. And my father, who sadly we lost, I read about my father in the book, but I lost my father to cancer about 18 months ago. And he was very proud because he once or twice nearly won that competition. He was second a couple of times, and he made some fantastic bread that he thought was the best bread anybody had ever baked.
But haven't some of the bakers been found cheating?
There was an incident with cheating one year where somebody had got his mother to bake the bread, and he was disqualified, and his name is dirt in our valley now.
Now, you went to Oxford University. Did you study shepherding?
No, I didn't.
I didn't think they taught that course.
No, I didn't. I studied American history. That'll make you laugh, won't it? So I studied things like the Lincoln-Douglas debates and the economic history of America and the way that this city and others like it emerged. These are things that I was interested in. So,
can anyone learn to be a shepherd? Is there a program somewhere?
There isn't. I mean, it's probably quite difficult because it's a very practical thing. It's like learning to be a carpenter or something. Really what you need to do is to start as young as possible and to commit yourself to it for a very long period of time. So you sort of go through a period of apprenticeship. But yes, humans can learn all sorts of things. So of course they can learn to be a shepherd.
What role do sheepdogs play in sheep farming? You say that All that is good about a sheepdog is based on the instincts of a wolf. And I was kind of surprised because I thought a wolf's instinct was to eat sheep.
So I was careful in my language on that. What we harness with the sheepdogs is the instinct, but stop it turning into the outcome that would happen with a wolf. So wolves are brilliantly intelligent at working as a pack to put prey animals into a certain place and then to attack them. What we do is with the sheepdogs is when they're very young, we harness that instinct, that desire to run around things, that desire to hold them with their eye, as we would call it, and we turn it into something much more harmless. So our dogs would never, ever hurt or bite a sheep, but we're using that same instinct and harnessing it. And
how do you train them?
It takes about 2 years. You start with them when they're about eight weeks old. You start with little simple things that you do with old dogs, teaching them their name, teaching them some sort of basic discipline. And then over time, you're letting their instinct to chase a sheep, but you're shaping that and turning it into something that you can harness and use. And their importance in our way of life can't be overestimated. If I took a couple of hundred New Yorkers onto a mountain where I live and we ran around without dogs trying to gather the flock, we'd fail miserably. But if I take three dogs, I can do it.
New York dog lovers might want to know whether your dogs sleep in your bed with you.
No, actually they don't. My dogs have very, very nice kennels, but they live in the barn. And I think they're happier there. They're absolutely work dogs. They don't really like being spoiled or having being sentimentalized. So when people come to my farm, they want to make a fuss of the dogs, and the dogs are fairly indifferent. They're just looking for the next job, and that's what they love. They get a buzz from that.
You have a section in the book called How to Speak Sheepdog. So maybe those visitors should learn a little sheepdog language.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is my sheepdogs think I'm the leader of their pack, the lead wolf, if you like. And they live for the things that they think they're meant to be on the earth to do, which is to round things up, to bring them into the pens, to stop when they're told. And they're really happy, actually, when you see that they've learned all of those things. They know exactly what their role in the world is, and they're doing it every day. They're really fit. They're an environment they understand and that's good for them, and they're incredibly healthy. So it's a good life for them and a good life for me, too. I'm very lucky.
Before you leave, you mentioned that you were an American history major, yet this is the first time you've been in the United States. Has anything surprised you?
One little thing just surprised me. About an hour ago, I went to Central Park, and I feel like I've watched on TV and in movies my whole life Central Park, but it's 100 times more beautiful than I thought it would be. When the sun was coming through the leaves, sort of fall leaves this morning, I was amazed by how beautiful that place is. And I think if I ever spent... I probably won't because I've got to go home and look after my flock. But if I spent more time in New York, I'd spend a lot of it in the green spaces, on the High Line, in the Central Park, those kind of places. I love those.
You know one of them is called the Sheep's Meadow.
I do. I'm going to go to the Sheep's Meadow. I'm going to be really disappointed if there isn't a brilliant flock of sheep in the Sheep's Meadow.
No sheep there. I'm sorry. A lot of sheepish people, though. James Rebanks, his latest book, The Shepherd's View, Modern Photographs from an Ancient Landscape, published by Flatiron Books. It's been a great pleasure having you on our show.
It's been a joy to be here and a privilege. Thank you very much, and thank you to your listeners.
For more than a century, the Friars Club has been hosting roasts and gatherings for its illustrious roster of members from the comedy world. And it has earned a legendary, almost mythic status in the minds of comedy fans. But on the occasion of the New York Comedy Festival, tomorrow night at 8:30 p.m., the Friars will, in a rare occurrence, open to the public a roundtable discussion about the business of comedy writing with some of the biggest names in the field. And I'm very pleased to be joined by three of them now, Larry Wilmore, an Emmy Award-winning producer, writer, actor, and comedian on shows like In Living Color, The PJs, more recently Blackish, HBO's Insecure, and, of course, The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore.
And The Bernie Mac Show.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to say at the end, and there are so many more things I could just spend the whole time.
So that would be in the et cetera part of the bio over there. Right?
Pamela Adlon, who's currently starring in FX's Better Things, a show she also writes, produces, and directs, and who also has been involved in shows like Californication, Louie, King of the Hill, and many other roles, both live action and animated. And Alan Zweibel, who has won many awards, was an original Saturday Night Live writer. He's worked on shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and It's Gary Shandling's Show. He's also an author and playwright. And I, as I said, I could probably spend half an hour just listing all the rest of the credentials of
you
this
should.
Group.
So cool.
You should.
I think yeah, why bother
that
having
would
a
job a lot easier.
I think
yeah,
that should be the entire
sweet.
Talk.
Well, I heard that one of the topics of discussion would be about how to get started in comedy writing. So let's start with that. Huh? How did you get into it, Larry?
I started writing funny things.
That's it. That's pretty much it. Most comedy writers have told me that slipped into it, that they were either performing or doing other things, and some
sure.
then they wound up writing.
Yeah, I always wrote out of necessity. I studied theater in college and, you know, studied playwriting and all that stuff. But when I was a stand-up, I needed an act, so I had to write jokes, and that's how I started writing comedy, because it was I always wrote out of necessity, so I needed an act, and I wrote an act.
When did somebody ask you to write for somebody else?
No, but I did that on my own. I would work with other comics, and I would just have ideas for their jokes and that kind of stuff in their act, and I'd say, hey, do this, do that, you know? And I just kind of organically started writing for other people just because I would have ideas. So.
Alan?
I wrote on purpose. I wrote jokes for stand-up comedians when I was in college yet, and mostly Catskill comedians. I sold them jokes. They paid $7 a joke. That was the going rate at the time.
My God,
and I wrote for over 100 of these guys that you've never heard of. And
Grossinger's,
the Neverly, the Concord, and I'd go up there to see.
Some of those guys were great.
They were very funny with the guys like Morty Gunty and names like Freddie Roman and Dick Lord, and I graduated to $10 a joke, $12, and the highest I got paid was $18 I got for a joke.
Do you remember that joke?
Oh yeah, it was about a Hasidic orgy where the men were on one side of the room and the women were on the other, and that killed up there.
That's hilarious.
And
it's even killing in the studio.
That is definitely an $18 joke.
No,
let me tell you.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. And then I got tired of writing for these guys who were twice my age, so I put all the jokes together and I did it as a stand-up act. With the two places in New York, the Improvisation and Catch a Rising Star, with the hope that somebody would come in and like the material. And Lorne Michaels walked in one night.
And so you were one of the original Saturday Night
Live writers. Yes, I was,
And Pamela?
Well, you know, my dad was a comedy writer. And so I have been writing my whole life. But I really started to write after I moved out of my house. And my dad and I had a decent relationship. And I would start to write little playlets between a father and a daughter, and I would be able to say like horrible things, and we would read them out loud to each other, and we'd be able to laugh. And so through that reflection is where my comedy voice started to come out.
Well, I've always wondered about writing jokes. Do they just come out of normal conversation and you realize that you're going somewhere and you just write it down? Or do you actually sit down to craft a joke? And if that's the case, how do you know?
Well, I don't write jokes. I mean, these guys write jokes. Sure. For me,
you write comic situations.
I always, like, I have my phone and I have, like, a drafts folder that's a mile long. And I write down things that I think are funny or a crazy observation to me. And I'm able to put that into my work.
Right.
But I don't write jokes.
Yeah. Well, joke writing, as Alan will attest, it can be done one of two ways. There's a technical aspect to it of constructing a joke, and then jokes come to you also. You know, it happens both ways. It's hard to explain.
No, that's absolutely right. The hardest thing to do is to sit down and say, I'm going to write a joke today. Mm-hmm. Okay, but
as a professional, you just have to do it.
You've got to do it.
Exactly.
So you find a topic. Hey, funny thing happened yesterday. I was walking down the street kind of thing. Or I was watching the debates. I would assume that. Has led to a few.
There are a lot
jokes.
Of different. It's funny. I taught how to write jokes at this college once, and I forced the students to look at like five different comics. One was Stephen Wright, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, a monologue like Jay Leno, and there was another and Rodney Dangerfield. And they had to use the same subject but write a different joke for each comic on the same subject. And so then what it becomes about is voice, you know. Mm. And what is the voice of the particular person telling the joke? So, like, if you're doing a Rodney Dangerfield joke, the joke has to be on you. It's self-deprecating. So you're looking for the punchline that serves it. I get no respect to tell you, you know. And so you're looking for the joke that the point of view that serves it. So if it's about relationships, it's like, hey, yeah, my wife, she wanted to have sex in the back seat of my car. She wanted me to drive. Huh, I tell you, it's terrible. Well, so you're looking for the thing that's going to do that to him.
You know, it's interesting you should say that, because when I started writing jokes, I would start off on Monday. I'd go, okay, the topic for this week is buying a car.
Right.
And Monday I would write a monologue, let's say back then, for Woody Allen, if he was going to do it, buying a car.
That's
then
great.
Jack Benny buying a car. By the end of the week,
cut that out.
Okay, I would have five monologues about the same thing with different voices, because I knew that one day I wanted to write scripts and I didn't want everybody to sound alike. I also wrote for Rodney. When you wrote for these comics that I wrote for, that was harder than writing for guys with personalities, because you were writing for nuance.
That's correct.
Okay, and characters. But to write a joke by itself where anybody could
a
do...
A foolproof joke. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's a harder thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, for example, Henny Youngman, he was hilarious, but he just seemed to have stock jokes.
Yes.
You've all worked on shows that build up a plot around a specific personality, whether it's Louis C.K., Bernie Mac, or Gary Shandling. Is it difficult to edit their jokes while you're still letting them showcase their senses of humor?
Well, in my situation, it's different. To me, the joke is the starting point for comedy. And when you write sketches, I believe sketches are just a longer form of the joke. And then your half-hour sitcom is a longer form, an even longer form of the joke that is done through a dramatization of the joke, let's say. And if you're going to, simplification terms. So when I'm dealing in a half-hour form, I'm really dramatizing a story. What is the story I'm servicing first?
So the jokes you wrote for those would not have worked on The Nightly Show, for
They're not
example.
Necessarily jokes in that form. It's kind of like what Pamela was talking about. You're really dramatizing humorous situations, and you're looking for ways to heighten the humor of it in completely different ways. Sometimes it's the way you cut something. Sometimes it's the way somebody says something. Sometimes it's the intention itself. That is the funny thing. There are a lot of different... Once you get into the dramatization of something, there are many ways to bring out what's funny, and so the joke takes on different form. When a joke is in a monologue form, it is a joke as we know it, where the words are the most important part of it, and the construction of the words. To me, the best way to describe a joke is a joke is a perfect sentence with the least amount of words with the highest amount of impact. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My guests are Larry Wilmore, Alan Zweibel, and Pamela Adlin. My guests are learning as they talk. We're talking about the Comedy Writers Roundtable 3 as part of the New York Comedy Festival, which will be open to the public on, that's tonight?
Tomorrow night.
At 8:30 p.m. at the Friars Club.
So that's where 57 you can East 55th Street. Or abduct us. We'll be there.
If you want anything from us, that's where we'll be.
Do we have a designated survivor?
Well, Larry, you
recently... We can call Kiefer Sutherland and come by.
In your case, Alan, you were one of the original writers on Saturday Night Live. What about that? You were writing for people like Rosanna Dana.
Yeah,
you did the samurai thing. How much? How much of
that
was
I'm
you?
Old.
No.
That means he's a
how much of that was you, and how much of that?
It's a combo platter. It's sort of like what Larry was talking about. I had the same thing with It's Gary Shandling Show. Mm-hmm. When Gary and I created that show, it's two people getting along. It's very social. And just like in any social situation, you share a sense of humor. And it's alike where you appreciate it, and the differences are as such where you also appreciate it. So there's a synergy there. Mm-hmm. You know, with Gilda, I hit it off with her right away. She made me laugh. She was an improv actress, as was Belushi, let's say, an improv actor.
You get the feeling that he was making up some of that samurai stuff on the
air.
Well,
you want to know something? John auditioned for the show. He brought that character to the show. Mm-hmm. And before I worked on SNL, before I got my break, I was supplementing my terrific living of selling jokes for $7 a piece by working in a delicatessen in Queens. So when we started the show, Lorne came up to me one day and said, you worked in a deli, right? I went, yeah. He says, okay, so write Samurai Deli. And I went, you bet, boss. And then he leaves. I'm going, what the hell is that? You know, so I sat with John, and then it's just a matter of melding the two things. And I could never have thought of that myself. Right. And then it was the collaborative thing. That's the fun part of any staff, you know, and the same thing with Gilda. Any of the characters that I helped create with her and for her, my God, I don't know how you divide it. I don't know if I know I couldn't have done it by herself, and hopefully myself, and hopefully I got it to a place that she wouldn't have been able to by herself. You know,
Pamela, before you got your own semi-autobiographical series, you worked on Louis, and now Louis C.K. is working on your show. What kind of working relationship do you have?
Well, it's creatively very fulfilling, because when we write tonally, we have the same voice. We speak the same way in the same cadence, and so it's just like we are able to interact in a way that, you know, I've tried to write with other people, and then I end up stripping it all down because it's just not my voice. And I like to, you know, I was saying today that I'm kind of like, I like to be like the king of subtlety and take everything down. And Louis's kind of like, you know, he's sort of like a puppet. He's like big up here. And I'm like, what are you doing with that? And he's like, oh, okay, I'll take it down. And then he's like, you got to bring it up, you know, because we don't, you know, that's when it comes to acting. But when it comes to writing, it's just a way we have of speaking. And for me, it's always, I'm very engaged in my life, but I've always been very observational. So I have just all of this, these images and these pictures in terms of my writing. And I was able to put that into his show and now my show.
What's it like tapping into your personal history for plot lines on a show?
Well, it's kind of a catch-22 because everybody's like, oh, this absolutely happened to me. This absolutely happened to all of my daughters in each developmental stage that they're in. And so it's almost a relief to be writing season two because, you know, I'm getting away from more of the personal stories, but nobody can really know. They'll just take everything as Bond for what I've written.
So. But a lot of sitcoms actually have drawn upon personal experiences. Everybody Loves Raymond,
absolutely,
for example. Louis.
Absolutely.
And Phil Rosenthal will be on the panel tomorrow night, the guy who created it. You know, I co-wrote 700 Sundays, Billy Crystal's one-man show.
He was on our show to talk about that.
And did he talk about me a lot?
He did. He mentioned you more than once.
But here I was helping another guy.
He said you were his mentor, and he learned everything from you.
You know something? He's a great guy, isn't he? But here, I was helping somebody else write their autobiography. So think about that. I had not met any of the people he was talking about. Now, in fairness, he's a Jew from Long Island. I'm a Jew from Long Island, so I knew the language. I had those characters maybe with different names, but in my life. But you end up, you know, whether it's a sitcom or a Broadway show or a personal film, you end up telling the story that you want. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So you leave out the stuff that is impertinent and it wasn't impactful to you, and you tell your own story.
Yeah, and also, like, working with Bernie Mac, I started with his setup about taking in his sister's kids, but the storytelling was my experiences as a child with a single mom and the experiences we had as writers in the room. We'd mentioned the things that we had gone through. We did an episode where Bernie got sick from the kids, and it came from me going to my daughter's school, and I got sick every single time I went to that school.
Yes.
And so I imagine a story where the germs, you could see the germs just coming at you, and they're just jumping from thing to thing, and that's how
that's
they,
awesome.
It just came
that's
out
great.
Of it.
I love that.
And what I felt was that nothing need be necessarily strictly autobiographical as much as it needs to be interesting. And it can start from the autobiography, but it doesn't have to be strictly that.
Absolutely. And once you get out of the fear, because people are asking me that now, like I'm all of a sudden, I've cracked a code because I'm drawing from my life.
Right.
I wanted to
And you're
going to
have to keep on drawing from your life because you got to hope
true.
That this is a
I have
series going to run a
so
long time.
So much material. It's crazy. But, you know, the thing is, I remember Phil saying in the writer's room, and Lou Schneider on Everybody Loves Raymond, they would come in on Monday and say, what happened to everybody this weekend? Sure. What happened?
And then he would send them home at 6 o'clock at night. And say, go home, have dinner with your family, live your lives. That's the only way we're going to be able to start feeding the show.
True? It's how Carl Reiner wrote the Dick Van Dyke show as well. He tells the same stories.
That's amazing to me, because honestly, people are like, did you plot out the whole season for years? No, actually, that happened to me 2 days before we filmed it. And
you're
I
listening to
everything.
The Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate talking with three very funny people. Unfortunately, sometimes we have to censor them. Larry Wilmore, Pamela Adlon, and Alan Zweibel. They are participating in the Comedy Writers Roundtable 3 as part of the New York Comedy Festival tomorrow at 8:30 at the Friars Club at 57 East 55th Street. And you can find out all about tickets on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. We'll take a little break and come back with more. And we are back with three very funny people, Pamela Adlon, Alan Zweibel, and Larry Wilmore. They will be participating in the Comedy Writers Roundtable 3 as part of the New York Comedy Festival tomorrow night at 8:30 at the Friars Club. That's at 57 East 55th Street. And it is free, but people still have to get tickets. They go to our website at wmyc.org.
Yeah, it's free, but they have to pay. I don't know how that works.
Now, you'll be emceeing it, Alan?
Yes, I will be.
So do you have all your questions prepared?
You know, I want to know something.
Larry
and I
were
talking about
it. You want me to hand you this?
We're going to do just whatever we're doing here today, exactly the same thing. No.
Donna Brazile has provided me with the question already. I just wanted to.
Here's the question. How do you get started? And then we're going to go from there. So, you know, we're probably going to ad-lib the whole thing or a good part of it.
I was asking earlier about mentorship. How important is it? Did each of you have somebody who kind of guided you in the early days? Silence. Okay.
Wow.
Well, I mean, my mentor is my dad, because my dad used to say to me, if you write one sentence every day, that's something. Just don't go a day without writing something.
Wow. And you've lived by that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been writing since I'm almost, you know, 10 years old when I got my first journal. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Louis really became my mentor. He really guided me. And he, you know, it almost feels like my legacy and my birthright to become a producer. And he made me a producer on Louis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, we started writing together on Lucky Louis, which was like 11 years ago. And I was able to find my voice and my confidence and build muscles that I never knew I had.
Yeah, I've always, I think, been inspired by peers on the way up, and then have tried to be a mentor, you know, in whatever place, you know, I've been in for as long as I have. And I enjoy that position a lot.
I'd imagine, Alan, in your case, being one of the original Saturday Night Live writers, that you were part of a group where you all just fed off of each other.
We did. It was very collaborative, and we all sought each other out. So synergistically, it worked that way. But as far as a mentor is concerned, somebody who is more experienced than me and helped guide me, there was a writer on the show who was a lot older than everyone else named Herb Sargent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he was a legendary TV writer. He produced a show called That Was the Week That Was.
Classic.
Yeah, and I even think he wrote radio towards the end of the radio days. Mm-hmm. And so he became a mentor. And then Buck Henry as well.
Yep,
I met him because he came in and he did The Samurais, and he was an orphan. He was often a host of the show, and our relationship, as I started doing more things, I would show it to him, and he would give
That's
me notes.
Great.
Yeah.
He also co-created Get Smart, and
he wrote The Graduate.
He wrote The Graduate as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've thought a lot about Saturday Night Live because it has changed over the years. Have you thought about the difference of starting something new versus working with an established format?
You know, it's interesting. I've had this talk with Tina Fey and Seth, and most recently, Colin Jost. Who had the bigger thrill was that we were a bunch of kids. Mm. Lauren gave us a job, and the only rule we had was to make each other laugh. Mm-hmm. And if we made each other laugh, you put it on TV with the hopes that other people would find it. And all of a sudden, our stuff was on TV, and this thing started happening. That was thrilling. Was that more thrilling than somebody who was a kid growing up watching this show and their dream coming true where they got to be on that show? Who was it more exciting for, you know? And
you got to have both.
Well, I got to have both, but you know, want to know something? I think the little kid growing up, it's like, you know, growing up across the street from Yankee Stadium and getting to play second base someday on the other side of that wall, you know?
Although I would argue that Garrick and Ruth had a pretty good time, too.
You want to know something? You're right. I stand corrected because I forgot about Murderers Row. Yes.
I was wrong, by the way. The event is not free. You have to buy a ticket, but it is open to the public.
Oh, okay.
Alan will buy all your tickets.
And they're not fine because I forgot Garrick and Ruth. It's on me.
And there's no food, but they are serving dinner. So it's full of contradictions the whole night. Yeah.
What about writing political humor, especially these days? The Guardian recently posted an article called "Is Satire Dead?" in which many TV writers claimed that it's getting harder and harder to write satire now. Do you agree?
Well, the death of comedy has always been proclaimed many different times, and then people have shockingly said, oh, I guess we were wrong.
It's like the novel. The people keep on declaring it dead, and then interesting books continue to
be
written.
I think as long as people are in power, satire has to exist. It's a form that will always be there.
Although we've now seen something different happen on Saturday Night Live, where in the case of the debates, they practically didn't even change some of the dialogue, just got laughs out of things that had really just been said.
They could have actually showed the actual debate.
Yeah, they could have rerun the debates. Yeah.
And it would have scored.
It just said it was Kate McKinnon. And we would have believed it.
And then Amando Iannucci pointed out in that article, he's the created British comedies and, of course, created Veep here. Mm-hmm. He said that so many things that sound serious during a debate are later written off as a joke and vice versa. And he used Donald Trump's line about putting Hillary Clinton in jail as an example. It didn't really sound funny, but Kellyanne Conway later called it a quip. Do these situations take some of the fun out of comedy writing?
I just think it takes the air out of people wanting to make fun of things, because you're saying, what's the difference between satire and seriousness? And right now, everybody's like got PTSD from the election, and we're all freaked out because it's so serious, yet it's so satirical. And we've all done that. If we don't have that, what do we have?
A recent article in Salon pointed out the coincidence between the release of the Donald Trump Billy Bush video and an episode on Better Things that showed your character Sam being sexually harassed on the set. Some could call that good timing or clairvoyance, but weren't you just writing about experiences that you and your peers have had?
Oh my God. I mean, forever. This isn't a new thing. It's just a thing that was in my show. So all of a sudden I was like in the of the zeitgeist of the moment. But I mean, this was said to me by a person in my life that they were like, you're just the right woman for me. Stick a rack on you and you're just my type.
Ooh.
And
stick a rack
on you. You're That's just my great. Type. And I was like, oh, thank you, sir.
That's hilarious.
Thank you, kind sir. And then, you know, the thing with the son who was my sitcom son exposing himself to me is sort of made up. But, you know, this is just what women have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Larry, you've been working on shows that address issues of race since the beginning of your TV career. Mm-hmm. You're an executive producer on the Issa Rae new show, Insecure. But you started on shows like In Living Color and the PJs, and they're very different from one another.
Yes.
Have things changed over the years? Are the kinds of things that might have gotten a laugh at the beginning of your career funny?
You know, well, I don't know. The reasons for why we're doing the jokes pretty much are the same. I remember we did a joke on the PJs that was pretty hard-hitting, where the two kids were talking to each other, And he said, Juicy, I hope we never grow old. And he said, well, the statistics are in our favor. And it was like this hard-hitting satiric.
Wow.
Satiric. I know, exactly. But you could do that I joke we did almost 20 years ago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a frighteningly, I mean, the sad reality of it is, you know, you look at some of the areas that we've been talking about recently and some of the lives that people face is the sad reality. But we were doing that satirical joke many years ago.
And much has been made about the 2016 White House correspondent dinner that you hosted. Seems like you stayed true to yourself despite the reactions you were getting.
I kept it 100, as we say on the show. Yes. I mean, to me, the idea of currying favor is not as appealing as telling the truth. So there you go.
Church.
Wow, good for you.
Church.
Well, actually, in the end, the ones where you tell the truth are the more lasting jokes, aren't they?
I think so. When you look at people like Carlin, all the people who we admire, and you don't have to tell the truth just by your content. You can tell the truth by your character as well. I mean, Jack Benny was true to his character. He was authentic to that true line of that. Mm-hmm. And it's still as funny today when you listen to it.
That was the longest laugh in radio came out of his silence. It was a radio sketch, right, where he was walking along, and he was known as the cheap guy, right?
Yes. Yeah,
and
yeah.
He was walking along, and a guy came along behind him, stuck a gun in his back, and said, your money or your life.
And
the
pause.
Longer he stayed silent, because you knew he was thinking
Killed
about
him.
It, mm-hmm. it, the laughs grew and grew and grew.
And the laugh line was, I'm thinking.
Finally, yes, when it reached the crescendo, the robber said, well, and he says, I'm thinking about it, and it shot back
That's
up
amazing.
Again.
Amazing. But he did a radio show in front of an audience.
He did it in front of a studio audience, yeah.
And then did it
like
as
we have here now.
Too, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. I'm wondering about.
Where are they?
I'm wondering about people who are funny but don't necessarily have jokes. Robin Williams, for example,
he could do
all of that shticky stuff, but then he needed other people. He would do his
other
bit, and
jokes?
Some other people would write the joke that would end the bit that he was developing.
Mm.
I had seen some Mark and Mindy scripts early on, and they would be regular scripts. You talk, I talk, you talk, I talk. And then there would be a blank where Mark would do whatever Robin wanted to do. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they just gave him free rein with the hope that he would end on the same line so the next person knew when to talk.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that cool?
Yes. I love knowing that.
Yep.
And that was network television.
Yes, Gary Marshall.
You also worked, Alan, on Gary Shandling Show, which people in this business.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, I think it's people in this business think it was the most accurate depiction of what a talk show was.
Can I
say
something?
Larry Sanders.
But Larry Sanders.
Gary Shandling Show predated that.
Yes,
that's where he spoke.
I met Larry Sanders.
Before Alan says, let me just say one of the most underrated. Great sitcoms of all time.
Yep.
I had the joy of just talking to Gary about it once, saying, Gary, this was years ago. Please put that out on DVD. It is one of the greatest shows ever.
Yeah.
Alan's White Bell, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow.
Gary Shandling was really unique, really, really funny, but smart funny. I'm sure you guys have had this experience where you work with somebody and they're on a different plane.
Yeah.
We all live here, okay? And they're just a little bit on
Alan,
a different
this
place.
This is radio.
You're
using
so for
your
you at home.
He's raising his hands
I'm
up
holding
high.
My hand in the middle.
Yes.
And now a guy like Gary, or when I was with SNL, yes. Dan Aykroyd or Michael O'Donoghue, I'm raising my hand now.
Elevate.
Okay, elevate. And they're on different levels
Absolutely.
Than everybody else. And you follow their lead. And
That's
I
right.
found that to be with Gary.
I was fortunate enough to work with Jon Stewart and felt the same thing. Jon just thinks on a different level. His insight is just deeper than most of humans, you know. And he's able to synthesize that every single day and distill it. And
my friend Larry David, I worked for a couple of years on Curb Your Enthusiasm, and Larry has been my friend, oh, God, since the club, since 74. Mm-hmm. Larry was another guy and is another guy who can take a little bit of minutia that we just pass over and not only calls it out, but makes a whole meal out of it. And, you know, wow.
And it's funny, yeah.
It's real funny.
You know who does that is David Duchovny, who was on Larry Sanders. He's brilliantly funny, and he was such good friends with Gary Shandling.
Yeah.
He worshipped him.
Yeah, indeed.
And, of course, Louis does the same thing with the little thought
Louis does
or
that
idea
as well.
In detail.
Yeah, he really does.
Now, Larry, you mentioned that you were on John's show.
Yes.
And when I think of all of the people who came out of that show, we have Colbert, we have Samantha Bee, we have John Oliver, we have you, and I'm probably missing a few others who have already gone on to have sterling careers on their own. Mm-hmm. Was there something that was happening on that show that led so many people, well, first perhaps attracted so many people to work on it and then led so many people to go out and establish variations, but personal variations?
It's hard to say. I mean, you can definitely say that John has an eye for talent, and he also has a generosity of the stage. You know, like Johnny Carson, he didn't mind promoting other people and letting people shine and letting people be funny. Look at all the people that came out of The Tonight Show as well. So John shares that. That's his legacy that he shares, I think, with Carson more than anyone else in late night, is that he did not mind for people to be funny. I mean, you could see him laughing when Steve Carell was another person came out, but they would make him laugh so much. And Oliver had this quality with John, too. And John loved that. He loved it. He loves it when other people are funny and when they shine.
And you mentioned Johnny Carson.
Yes.
I thought he was the most brilliant straight man ever.
Yeah.
He'd be interviewing Rodney Dangerfield, and he'd be asking these perfectly straightforward questions. And then later you realize that these were all questions that were feeding Rodney opportunities.
Yeah, softballs that he was giving up, and they just knock it out.
Both,
you know,
Johnny Carson and Carl Reiner, to me, are the funniest and best straight men who were also funny. Those two.
Yeah.
You look at Carl Reiner, you look at 2,000-year-old man albums and
absolutely.
Whatever. There is an art to what he does. He's
That's
brilliantly
correct.
Funny, one of my big, big heroes.
Mine too. Yeah.
And what he does is he allows Mel Brooks to just be Mel.
Yes.
And he reins him in and he keeps it there and he keeps it coherent. But God, he's a master at
he
that.
He is a master. And he's a funny straight man, but he has that generosity as well, Carl Reiner.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what's next for you, Larry? The show is no longer on the air, but...
What?
You're writing...
He was on
his
way there now.
You're writing for all sorts of other things.
Doing a lot
of... You're going to have your own show again?
It's possible. I'm developing, creating shows again. I'm about to make an announcement for it, so I can't actually say it right now, but... So I'm very excited about that, and currently writing a movie. And I'm always doing a lot of different projects at once, and I'll figure out a way to get, you know, back in front of the audience in a certain way. So we'll figure that out.
Alan?
I'm always doing a lot of things also. Just sold a piece to The New Yorker. I also, the thing that I love the most that I'm working on currently, I was asked to write the script for a Broadway musical version of the movie Field of Dreams.
Oh, wow.
So I'm working
Is it going to be funny?
God, you know something? A little bit more than the movie was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will be fun.
And Pamela, in your case, your hands full with a show.
Yeah.
Have you shot the first full season?
The first season, the ninth episode's on tomorrow, and then the finale next week. And I'm doing 92nd Street Y tonight. I'm writing my second season. And I'm doing the New York Comedy Festival tomorrow night.
Yeah.
But then you do voiceover work on cartoons.
I do. That's my bread and butter. I ain't getting paid for the other thing.
I mean, King of the Hand.
Is that difficult to do?
Oh, no. It's the best. I mean, you know, do you love what you do? I mean, your thing is you're guiding all of us. For me, it's like you go in and make voices with legends, and it's just the greatest thing. It's the best job in the world.
To some degree, it's like doing a comedy show, except that you're not going to be seen on camera.
Yeah, because I get to work with people like Billy West and Jim Cummings and all of these legends, and it's just the greatest thing you could do.
Pamela Adlon, Larry Wilmore, Alan Zweibel, three of the participants in the Comedy Writers Roundtable 3. Which is part of the New York Comedy Festival. It'll be tomorrow night.
With the legendary Phil Rosenthal.
And also Mike Reese.
And
Mike
Reese from
The Simpsons.
Who I do a Jewish thing with every year.
That's hilarious.
With Mike?
with Phil.
Oh.
And you can find out information about tickets on our show page at wnyc.org/Lopate. We're finished, but the show can go on after.
Let's keep talking.
No, let's keep talking.
You can thank you all for being here.
Yeah, we'll clean up.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.